Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success.
Please join Robert Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Welcome back to the Culture and Sports Podcast. Today we have a great guest for you, Wayne McDonald. He is the teaching assistant professor for the UNC Sport Administration, and he's also an ACC Network Extra at the and college baseball analyst. How are you doing today, Wayne?
Doing well, Jeremy. Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to having this wonderful conversation with you today.
Thank you, Wayne. Can you give us a little bit more about your background?
Well, I have a very unique background, to be honest with you. I tell everyone I wound up in academia by accident. When I went to college and graduate school, I was training to work in finance. I did my undergraduate studies in accounting and finance, and I went for my MBA in management. Once I finished my MBA, I always knew I wanted to work in sports. So as I was finishing my MBA, I was interviewing, and I was presented with an opportunity to go to Madison Square Garden and become a financial analyst. And I'll never forget my first interview there, and I think it was the coolest thing. And I knew right away, I said, I want to go. I want to work there. I was being interviewed for a facilities finance, financial analyst position. And as the interview was going on, it was sound check for Elton John. So I knew right away the energy, the excitement. I had to be in an environment where there was a lot of energy. And I had the great fortune of working in Madison Square Garden. And once I got there, I started working with the Rangers, working with all the concerts, the different events. So I've done everything that's between the finance and accounting for a major arena and professional sports teams. I worked Rangers, Liberty, Knicks, concerts, events, you name it. And it was just a wonderful experience to see all aspects of an arena and sports. I even worked the Grammys, which was a really cool thing. So it opened my eyes to a lot of different things. And it also made me realize I love sports even more. Because I was born and raised in the Bronx. I grew up playing baseball to a very old age at the semi-professional.
Did you start with stickball?
Started with wiffle ball. I was never good at stickball. Right. I was never good at stickball. Jeremy, I was awful at stickball. I could never do it. So our thing, because we grew up in the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx, was you either play wiffle ball, and in the back of the garage was always the strike zone. It was either wiffle balls or the tennis balls. You weren't allowed to play with the blue balls because they would just go all over the place. So what we used to do as kids, we used to roof all of these wiffle balls, and the neighbors would get so mad at us. But there was one across the street who was such a good guy. He said, come on over, and he gave us a bucket full of our wiffle balls from his roof. So the thing is, I grew up in a sports family. We all played. You know, my dad played basketball, but we were encouraged at a very early age, free play, creative play, be imaginative. So we played every sport. But as we grew older, my brother and I in particular, we gravitated towards baseball. And then it turned into a sick and twisted obsession with the both of us to this day. So we played everything. And I think that was the beauty of growing up in one of the five boroughs of New York City. It was just that you were encouraged to go outside. You were encouraged to play. Your parents said, just go, have fun. There was no helicopter parents. There was none of that. So very early on, the beauty of sports was encouraged in our family. And even to this day that, You know, it's just a major part of all of our lives. So I knew that when I got into the professional world. So I had a colleague of mine who was adjuncting at my alma mater. And my brother had taken his course and said, you really have to talk to this guy. His name is Scott Amon. He works at WWE. And we met for a burger one night, and I realized right away this is a kindred spirit. And he said, eventually, over time, he said, I'm going to NYU, and we're going to I'm teaching sports law down there. It's great. Hey, how about you come down and join us as an adjunct? He introduced me to a man by the name of Jonathan Rosenberg. We met in a Mexican restaurant in Grand Central Station, and we spoke for hours, and I realized these were people I wanted to be around. And then after that, I met a mutual friend of the both of ours, a man by the name of Bob Bolin, and then that just sealed the deal for me, where I looked at these individuals and said, all right, these are people who speak my language. These are people who love sports. These are good people who have morals, character, and integrity, and I want to be around them. And that's when I actually was in a little bit of a transition from Madison Square Garden into corporate America. Now, I jokingly tell my students, and Jeremy, you'll laugh at this, I say to students, I did a 2-year jail sentence in corporate America. The moment, I'll never forget, the moment I got to my desk at a company called Marsh & McLennan, I realized it wasn't for me. I went, oh, wow, you know, because it was different. It was just different. I needed to be around the energy, the excitement, the enthusiasm, people that motivated me, stimulated me, made me think differently, have opinions and debates. And that's where one night a week I was adjunct at NYU. It turned into 2 nights a week. Then it turned into I'm taking my days off and I'm spending them with Bob and Jonathan and Scott playing flag football with the students on the east side of Manhattan on Houston Street. So it really gravitated into something special where 2 years later they had come to me and asked me to interview for a faculty position. And over a 17-year period, I went from an adjunct and I became an academic chair and a clinical professor of sport. And, you know, there's a lot of people to thank along the way for that. Obviously, Scott Amon and Jonathan Rosenberg, our dear friend Bob Bolin, played an instrumental role even to this day in so many different things. So I did that on top of I was a semi-professional baseball player. I ran my own semi-pro team for a number of years. I coached for over a decade at the high school level. I coached at my alma mater, Iona Prep. I was in that private instruction world for a very long time, that tournament world for a very long time. So I know that all so well. So then when I began the process of interviewing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, it happened to have begun on January 6, 2021, a very famous day in American history, or infamy, as we like to kind of look at it these days. And by the time the process was over, it was about March 2021, they extended an offer to me, and I accepted. And then, as you know better than anyone, the college athletics world changed in July of that year. Mm-hmm. And I was in the epicenter of a new environment for me, because I had basically come from a D3 school where if sports were tertiary, that was a lot, even though kids worked hard and, you know, there was a nice culture there, but nothing like what I was going into. Right. North Carolina is a beast of a different animal, and I mean that with the highest of regards. Mm-hmm. And it was humbling, it was overwhelming, but also I saw right away where I could be an asset to student athletes in a very tumultuous period of time. And that was really as a voice of reason, common sense, compassion, and a sounding board, because one, I was an athlete, two, I organized, I was a coach, ran my own teams. Three, I work for professional sport franchises. And four, I give a damn about people. Mm-hmm. And that really led to a lot where my office had become a repository for just an exchange of ideas. And colleagues started to pass comments saying, there's a lot of student athletes in your office. To this day, that's how it is. It's a great opportunity to analyze and dissect the world that we're living in terms of college athletics, which right now is very scary. It's uncertain. I felt great attending the summit last week because when I'm listening to all these brilliant people and thought leaders that I feel they are in college athletics feel the way I do, I said, thank God I'm not alone. So what I really love is I work with world-class student athletes every day. They motivate me. They inspire me. I think they make me a better educator. They make me a better advisor. And I just love, you know, going and having these conversations where one minute I'm talking about swing mechanics with a baseball player to the next minute I'm talking about the future of Title IX and House versus the NCAA and what does that mean for their worlds. And the other great thing is I've been exposed in such a positive way to women's sports at the collegiate level, and it has been downright awesome. Field hockey in particular, I'm in awe of what Coach Mattson's doing at UNC. Women's tennis, women's swimming and diving, women's lacrosse has won the national championship since I've been there. Women's soccer at UNC, as Coach Smith has called it many times over and over throughout his distinguished life, UNC is a women's sports school. It's not a basketball school, as many people think it is. So in my short time in Chapel Hill, I really have to thank the student athletes for opening my eyes to so many wonderful things, but also educating me, because the way I look at college athletics right now, I think it's very unique, because in my role in Chapel Hill, one, I'm in a world-class sports administration program. I'm very spoiled there with extraordinary colleagues. We're in the Department of Exercise and Sports Science, amazing people to work with on a daily basis. So I have that role. I'm an academic advisor to 300 sport administration students. I'm also a mentor to many student athletes. I'm a fan who attends all the events, and also I'm a broadcaster. So the lens that I'm looking at college athletics right now is vastly different than a lot of people, because I'm having conversations on different perspectives where I think a lot of people outside of our world that we're traveling in, Jeremy, a lot of people just looking at it as the fan athlete dynamic, when we're looking at it from a far more holistic point of view, and that there are far more stakeholders in the dynamics right now, and we just can't look at this as being transactional. There's a lot of depth and breadth here, and there's a lot of areas for concern. So I'm extremely fortunate that I'm at a place like Chapel Hill in our Department of Exercise, Sports Science, Sport Administration. And I say this, if we're talking about a team of people that I've worked with, the sport administration program at UNC, to me, it's like an all-star team. And I joke with everyone, say, I'm the water boy on the team. you know, because it's just a very special place with special people. And I think we're at a critical point in time in college athletics, and I like being able to have conversations with the people that I am, because they're thoughtful, they're intelligent, they're caring, because they realize that college athletics right now is far more than revenue sharing and unionization and NIL and collectives. It's about the social, emotional, and mental competencies of the student athlete. Because what I get that a lot of people don't is when that student comes to my office and says, I'm out of eligibility, I've committed 20 years of my life to this sport, what do I do now? I'm 23, I'm 24 years old, I'm done, I'm not going to go professional in the sport to which I've given my life to, what's next? And we have a lot of those conversations. And on the flip side, I have a lot of conversations too with, hey, I could get drafted. In fact, I might be a first round draft selection in my respective sport. What does that look like? And having these very fascinating conversations. Nothing could have prepared me to go into Chapel Hill. Nothing. Mm. Regardless of, you know, the 20 years of experience that I had working at my alma mater, Iona University, New York University, and, you know, Dr. Hedlund's program at St. John's University was overtly generous to me during the pandemic and allowing me to teach there for two semesters. Even with those great people, great experiences, and world-class universities, nothing could have prepared me what would have happened July 2021 walking into North Carolina. So I think I've grown and developed along with college athletics because we were on the same trajectory. As I was arriving in Chapel Hill, so was NIL.
Right, right. So you said a few minutes ago that this is a critical time in college sports or college athletics. Can you expound on that a little bit?
I'm worried, Jeremy, to be honest with you. Okay, obviously, we have spent a tremendous amount of time talking about House versus the NCAA. What's that going to look like? When you're starting to use terms like revenue sharing in college athletics, my mind goes to unionization. My mind goes to compare the balance, haves versus have-nots. But then the big thing that I'm going to is Title IX compliance. And what is this going to look like? I was thinking about this morning, again, in preparation for our conversation and some of the conversations I'm going to have later on today and tomorrow with student-athletes. We currently have 28 varsity sports in North Carolina, and that's unbelievable. I mean, and it's tremendous. My thought is, what's the next 3 to 5 years going to look like? Right. Are we going to have 28? We might have 24. We might have 22. We don't know what this is going to look like. And then the big thing I look at, where is the money going to come from with regard to revenue sharing? We're talking about private equity, and that is a very treacherous slope. I thought Dr. Weaver last week in the summit nailed it in terms of what she was talking about, where she's currently educating university presidents on how to work with private equity and really depend upon your board of trustees. Because private equity, the rules are so different, the expectations are vastly different, and the big thing is they want return on investment, and they're not patient about it. So that worries me. The mental health and the overall well-being of the student athlete worries me deeply because I see the pressure. A typical day for me would be I'm starting my student athlete meetings between 5 and 6 in the morning. And in some cases, those student athletes have already either been in the gym, they've been in the pool, they have been doing their lifting programs. An example that always stays with me, my first 2 years in Chapel Hill, my parking spot was right behind the batting cages at Boschma Stadium. And I'm pulling in at 5 o'clock in the morning, and the only thing I hear, which has been the soundtrack of my life, is a baseball bat hitting a ball. And I go to my 8 o'clock class. A lot of these student athletes have been practicing and honing their craft for a couple of hours.
Or yeah, they've already been up for like 4 or 5 hours at your 8 o'clock class.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because they'll say to me, hey, is it okay if I can't make office hours, can I meet you outside? I go, great, what time? Hey, how's 5 in the morning? I go, fantastic, let's go. And that has been a big thing because student-athletes can't meet with me Tuesdays and Thursdays between 12:30 and 3:30. It doesn't work. So the one thing I learned is you got to be quick and nimble. You got to be accessible. You got to be a good listener. You got to be a problem solver. Now, you're not going to be able to solve all the problems. And the one thing that I've learned very quickly is when things get too heavy where you can't provide a concrete answer or solution to help these student athletes, North Carolina has been phenomenal. There's a lot of resources to help there. But some of it's getting even more complicated due to NIL, due to collectives, you know. And then I'm trying to tell students, you know, you have to pay taxes. You know, that's a big part of this. Jeremy, you'll get a kick out of this. So I take my daughter for a walk on campus, you know, very proud walking around Chapel Hill and the different facilities. And so we're walking past the practice football facility, mm-hmm. and the gate opens up, and it's this gorgeous Mercedes-Benz. And I turn to my daughter and say, I watch, that's going to be Coach Mac Brown. You know, just make sure you wave, right? So the car comes out, the window rolls down. I'm thinking it's going to be Coach Brown. It's one of my students. Hi, Professor McDonald. How you doing? And then I go, NIL's not too bad, is it? A big smile on his face. So I look at it. Yes, I'm very worried. Just worried about I'm seeing these extraordinary student athletes burning the candle at both ends. And then what was presented in one of the panels last week by the student athletes was so spot on. You have to be a social media expert to promote your brand as well, which is a tremendous amount of work. So throw in the 20 hours of practice. Throw in the travel now, because now in our conference, we're traveling now to California and Texas.
Yeah.
And a little bit different than going down the road to Duke or an hour away to Winston-Salem or to Raleigh, you know, which we're very accustomed to. Now it's Cal and it's Stanford and it's SMU, and it's an entirely different dynamic. So there's a lot of things being thrust upon these exceptional young people at a short period of time, and they're expected, which is unfair, which is completely unfair, to be able to solve all these problems when they're in the classrooms right now trying to figure it out for themselves. So I'm very worried on so many fronts, Jeremy.
So it sounds like you're more concerned about the athletes themselves, not only about their well-being, but also about their safety. And you know, their safety could be not only, you know, financial safety, you're talking about taxes and other things, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, the candle burning at both ends. So it sounds like you're talking more about also mental, physical, and emotional health, you know, both short and long term.
Absolutely, Jeremy. I would say if I had to prioritize that would be number one. Because like I had mentioned, I'm in a very unique position because I get to see the student athletes from a wide variety of lenses. Where, yes, it's the faculty, it's the academic advisor, it's the mentor, it's the fan, but it's also the broadcaster. Where I'm in a broadcast booth and I'm seeing different things. I'm talking to the coaches in the conference. So I look at it as a very all-encompassing view. And then I'll go into meeting with these student athletes, and they're worried about their eligibility. They're worried about their grades. They're worried about practice. They're worried about falling behind. They're worried about conference realignment and what that travel is going to look like for them. Give you an example. I was talking with some baseball players at the end of last season, and we had a pretty good run in Chapel Hill last season, wound up in the College World Series. And a lot of the players who were done in terms of eligibility and were moving on either to minor league ball and different professional baseball opportunities, they were saying, thank God we're not going to have to make the trip out to Stanford or Cal or Texas, you know, wherever the conference was going to go. Because in a case like North Carolina, a place like Boschma Stadium, I would say 60-70% of their games are played there because it's such a beautiful facility.
Right.
And the travel is very limited because, you know, we got Duke, Wake Forest, North Carolina State, a stone's throw away. And the big travel before all this was to Boston College. You know, that was the big travel. Now
right.
It's different. So these are all the things that are the undercurrent that are on the forefront of the student athletes' minds, on top of academic excellence and then maintaining eligibility. If they have an extra year, okay, I'm done with my undergraduate studies. Where am I going to graduate school? What program am I going to go to within that university, or do I have to leave? And I've seen so many wonderful student athletes I've grown very close to and still have conversations with, had to leave because the graduate programs that they wanted to study in were not offered at UNC. Right. And then it turns into a coach conversation, a program. And let's not even talk about the transfer credits. That's a whole other situation. So that's why, for me, there are so many levels here that have to be taken into consideration, from the social, emotional, and mental competencies, but as well as just looking at these young men and women as 18 to 22-year-olds still trying to figure all this out for themselves. And they're not content experts. And neither are we, given the changing landscape of how quickly everything's going.
And do you think that, academically speaking, do you think that the student athletes or students or athletes, do you think that it's going to be more difficult for them to maintain degree completion and other things based off of the evolution where, you know, athletes might become or employees of the school? And do you think that the focus will be way less on academics? And I know for athletes, some athletes are there just to try to make it to the next step, right? You know, in their sports career. But for the bulk of the athletes that UNC Chapel Hill currently has, and just across the board in general in collegiate sports, do you think that academically things will stay the same, or do you think things will be different in a positive or negative direction? Where do you think, from your seat, that seems like?
Well, I think it would be foolish to ignore it. But I will say, once again, I am very fortunate to work in the department that I am working in with the colleagues that I am, because it's about academic integrity. It's about acting in the best interest of the student athletes and revisiting your curriculum in a very thoughtful manner. I think you want to be quick and nimble, but you still want to maintain that robust curriculum. And the reality is, right now, I would say at least 85 to 90% of the student athletes that I'm dealing with, they see the forest through the trees. That mm-hmm. The reality is they're going to have an amazing athletic career at North Carolina, and they do. And it's a wonderful place to go to school. But they know that they're not going to be going professional in their respective sport. So there's always the eye of graduate school or careers. And, you know, we try to set them on a path where every year our department runs a summit where we bring back alums who work in sports to network with about 200 of our current students. And we have an internship fair. I think our program does a very good job of saying you're going to be a world-class athlete in North Carolina, and that's an amazing accomplishment. But let's look at the statistics. The NCAA's famous statistic of what, like 2% of all college athletes are going to go professional in their sport? Well, we get that. And that's why I think we're kind of pivoting in the direction where, some classes right now that might be required, we might have to make an elective. We might have to change here and there to adapt to certain circumstances, but under no circumstances is the rigor or merit of the academics going to be compromised by it. And I'm really proud of that. But we're also having those serious conversations of, hey, things are changing. We don't know what's going to look like yet, but you know, we got to make sure we're acting in the best interest of our students. And like I said, 85 to 90% of the student athletes I've dealt with, they get it. They really do. And that's why I'm so in awe of them, because I rarely have a situation where I'm scratching my head. It's more of there's a game plan in place and we're just working with it. But yeah, I think academic programs are going to have to seriously look at this because – Let's put it this way. Where's $22 million going to come from every year in athletics? That's a serious, serious worry with House versus the NCAA. And that's going to trickle down not only from football and basketball, where a lot of the revenue is made, But my worry is going to go into the sports that have opened my eyes to a whole new world of college athletics, like field hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Field hockey has just blown me away. And, you know, going to those matches and talking with the athletes and seeing that, you know, coming from a one-dimensional baseball person, you know, learning so much from these athletes and the beauty of college athletics. And I've been very professional sports-oriented, given my background, given where I have come from. But North Carolina and Chapel Hill has opened my eyes to such the beauty of college athletics, and I want that to continue. But I'm very worried about where we're going. Are we just, I hate to say pay for play, but that is going to be the reality. And, you know, seeing all these great coaches retire, and I think it's a byproduct of the changing landscape. And do they want to deal with the headaches of NIL and starting to talk to 14-year-olds about what can they make if they go to North Carolina in terms of collectives and NIL and all of this stuff? So it worries me.
Yeah, can you actually talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think the landscape right now is very shaky. I think the UNLV situation
that's a great one.
Yeah, it woke us all up where we said, wait, that wasn't in writing? And then you talk to a student athlete and you have these nice conversations. They're like, oh, this stuff happens all the time. You know, the only reason why it's making noise is because it was put on social media and everything. So, you know, the way conference realignment is happening, the way the media rights deals are handled, because the power rests right now in the Big Ten and the SEC, okay? And I have the great fortune of being in an amazing conference in the ACC with terrific schools and everything, but we're far behind in terms of what the Big Ten and the SEC are doing from a broadcast media rights deal. And that will catch up at some, like, we're locked in, I know at North Carolina, we're locked in probably for another decade with ESPN. And at the time it made sense, but now, you know, there are legitimate worries over it. So, you know, you're looking at, all right, where's NIL going to look? Where is House versus the NCAA going to look? How is that going to position recruits in terms of the universities they look at? My mind goes to states with no state tax, which means mm-hmm. states like Florida and Texas and Nevada and Washington, right, and Tennessee are going to benefit. And there are a lot of SEC schools in those states. And look at what happened with Tennessee they just did. They put the 10% NIL surcharge on all tickets, and they increased their football tickets by almost 5% on top of that because they're realizing the money is going to have to come from somewhere. And right. why not the fans? So those are the things that are concerning, because then it's the pressure being put on the student-athletes that you better perform, because if you don't perform, we're not going to get, you know, alums donating to collectives, and, you know, maybe your sport might be on the short list at some point in time to be, you know, done away with. And those are legitimate worries. And then it turns into a space issue. You know, how, you know, because most universities are real estate endeavors when you really think about mm-hmm. it. And you're putting all this money into resources like football and basketball. But what happens to the other sports that need a little TLC along the way? Maybe you're not going to invest in them because it's not worth the real estate. So it's so complex and on all those levels, and it goes well beyond, for me, football and basketball.
Now, you're talking, you know, so you brought up a great point about the other sports. I mean, isn't the UNC Chapel Hill women's soccer team like won more national championships than all your other sports combined?
I walk by Dorrance Field every morning to go to my office, and there's something like 22 national championship banners hanging there. And look, I look at it from the perspective, if we're talking about the explosion of women's soccer at the national level in this country, the epicenter is Chapel Hill. And it goes beyond Mia Hamm. As wonderful as Mia Hamm is, she's going to be our keynote graduation speaker this year, which is going to be awesome. But when you look at the legacy of Anston Dorrance in terms of women's soccer and what he did to put that sport on the map globally in terms of the United States and the talent that comes down out there, it's downright extraordinary. And then next to that is Shelton Field, where Karen Shelton's name's on that stadium for field hockey. And there are 10 national championships attributed to her and one to Coach Erin Mattson. And, mm-hmm. you know, you have these great legacies in women's sports. But at the end of the day, 50,000 people aren't going to show up to watch a soccer game. 50,000 people aren't showing up to watch field hockey. In fact, I have people from the soccer program in my office all the time saying, how can we put together game plans to bring more people to watch these events? And, you know, in a couple of years, again, we're going to be hosting the Final Four for field hockey. And Cary hosts the Final Four, which is down the road from campus. So there's a lot of this activity, but then there's also a lot of worry that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's... So when we're talking about, you know, major sports like, you know, men's football and men's and women's basketball, so there's a risk of some sports eventually being on the chopping block at, you know, colleges and universities that are like the worst negative revenue generating sports. But what's going to happen to basically all the sports except for men's and women's basketball and men's football, like in the grand scheme of things? Are we just going to see colleges and universities with three sports or maybe four or five sports and that's it? Like how, like, and I'm not trying to say, oh, it's doom and gloom for everything, but where do you see the revenue generating sports and the non-revenue generating sports?
Well, I'm worried about that because obviously you're going to look at football and basketball. And here was something that bothered me. Our women's basketball program has gotten significantly better. And there's a lot of excitement around our women's basketball program. And we had South Carolina come to campus last year and play. And my office is over Carmichael Arena. And I completely forgot. I lost track of time and everything. And I open up my window and go, wow, there's like a party outside going on. And then I remembered, South Carolina's in town, and it was amazing. Now, the women are playing UConn this year, but they're not playing UConn on campus, which is, to me, one of the worst things to do because we had such a great vibe. They're playing them in Greensboro. We had such a great vibe with South Carolina. It was a good game. People realized, hey, wait, here's the big thing I've learned. You get fans to go to women's sporting events at the collegiate level, they're going to get hooked very quickly because they're going to realize how great the sport is. And that was me for field hockey. I went over, you know, because I obviously work with a lot of the players and everything, and I went, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And I also remember, at that moment, I realized the true beauty of college athletics, diversity. Variety is the spice of life. And, you know, if you were to talk to anyone who has known me for a long time, I'm a one-trick pony when it comes to baseball. But being at Chapel Hill, I've been to field hockey. I've been to soccer. I've been to all the different sports and loving every minute of it. And, you know, I loved seeing last year when North Carolina hosted the field hockey national championship. Obviously they played against Northwestern in it. Hours before the game, lines wrapped around campus. Now you see that when Duke plays North Carolina in basketball or on a regular Saturday for football, but it warmed my heart to see that. And it warmed my heart to see it with some of the soccer matches. But what I look at is, my worry with all of this is women's sports. And what message are we going to send that, hey, look, you can have a, you know, a 5-7 football team, you know, and they're going to get X amount of dollars, but then you have an undefeated national championship winning field hockey or women's soccer or women's tennis or swimming and diving, but we're going to put them on the chopping block because of the money. And here's the other thing that might happen. Because of the way this is all going, it wouldn't surprise me, and I had this conversation with a great colleague of mine, that some sports might have to go to the alumni base and say, this is preventive maintenance. We might be on the chopping block, so we're going to need you to really give back in terms of donations for collectives and NIL. If not, we're not going to be able to survive. And that would be a human tragedy for me. Because I think one of the beauties of college athletics is the diversity of it. And I love walking around campus and seeing student athletes going to different types of practices. Or watching the intramurals in our building and seeing all this wonderful, vibrant athletic activity on the practice field. There's something to me powerful about that. I think a portion of that is going to go away. Look, I spoke with a bunch of football players. I had a very long conversation with a few football players about 2 weeks ago. And what they said to me was really enlightening, because I never thought of it this way. They said, with the new changes that are going to happen with the rosters beginning next year, there's not going to be any walk-ons anymore. And right. one of the big things that these football players were telling me, the culture of their team was the walk-on finally earning the scholarship and how empowering that was to everyone. And that was one of the big things they looked at and said, 105 for football and no walk-ons? Okay, this is not going to look good. So I look at the student-athletes right now, and they're really getting in tune with this. But, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years, we might be looking at a vastly different landscape. Now, we used to have the Power Five. Now we're down to the Power Four. In reality, Jeremy, we could be down to the Power Two. And I don't think it's too out of the realm of possibility for that to happen, given where the broadcast revenues are, given the taxation-ish, friendly tax states that there are, and what does that mean for some, you know, natural rivalries?
Do you think that this is going to turn into collegiate sports 100 years ago, where there were basically two big conferences and that were important and everything else was just kind of on its own?
It worries me that way, but then I also remember, too, there was a point in time where Teddy Roosevelt would call everyone to the Oval Office and say, hey, football's out of control with the injuries.
Right.
To me, what makes college athletics special is diversity. Diversity of sport, the ability to sport sample, even with a very strong intramural culture within your university. I that's the big power that I see as well. But, you know, if this is going to turn into professional basketball and men's and women's and, you know, professional football at the collegiate level, boy, we're doing ourselves a massive disservice, because the life skills that sport teaches are transferable. And I had this conversation with a group of student athletes the other day. I said to them, you don't realize how many skills you've acquired through sports that you're going to be able to transfer into other aspects of your life very quickly. And we're not talking about just football and basketball players. I'm talking about rowers. I'm talking about divers. I'm talking about swimmers. I'm talking about softball players, you know? And then the light bulb goes over their head and says, yeah, time management, perseverance, discipline, working as a team, you know, sometimes handling a difficult coach, or, you know, working with an enlightening coach. You know, what does that mean? So all of these things to me are the beauty of college athletics that are kind of being pushed to the side, where it's like, where are we going to find $22 million on an annual basis? How are we going to pay it? And if we have the haves versus have-nots, what is it's going to look like? And if private equity is involved, what is the definition of return on investment going to be? And what is going to be the time frame? Because look, we've already seen the NFL and what they're doing with private equity and how careful they are being with the process and how long you have to be invested into it and how selective they are, will college athletics do the same in terms of due diligence, or is there going to be a free-for-all? To be determined.
Yeah. Before we sign off, I want to thank you for coming on today, Wayne. I really do appreciate it. I know our viewers and listeners do as well. But before we do go, I wanted to ask, is there anything you would like to share with our viewers or listeners, athletes, parents, coaches, athletic directors, universities, colleges, conferences, the NCAA, or these collectives, conglomerates? Do you have anything to share with them about the future of college sports?
I just hope people look beyond the dollars and cents. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, life is short. And I think with age and through experience, I've learned to kind of take a step back and appreciate where you are. And not a day goes by that I don't appreciate that I work with amazing people in Chapel Hill. And the student athletes are probably the most special people I've ever worked with, hands down. And I just am very worried about their social, emotional, and mental well-being, and that they're being taken advantage of in certain situations where it's all about the money rather than about their growth and development. And I tell them all the time, 18 to 22-year-olds, you're allowed to make mistakes. You're allowed to be a little goofy, you know. But having that support system around them is critically important. And sometimes you might want to give up on a dollar or two to make sure the athletes are being cared for and all their needs are being met. And that doesn't necessarily mean the best fitness equipment or the best facilities or the best travel, as much as building a support system around these student athletes where they can thrive, grow, and excel in other areas outside of their sport. And like I said, Jeremy, I'm very spoiled because I get to look at college athletics through a wide variety of lenses, something I don't take for granted. And the student athletes I've worked with over the past 4 years at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, have taught me volumes. And it taught me, most importantly, to be of service to others, to be accessible, and to understand that sometimes what a student athlete truly needs the most is someone to listen to them. So that would be some of the things I would like to impart upon this wonderful audience that you have.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture and Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.